This webcast is made possible by the listener members of the Classical Network and WWFM.org. Thank you for your support. Jacobs Music Company is the proud sponsor of Between the Keys with Jed Distler. Information on any of the products or services that Jacobs Music offers is available on their website, www.jacobsmusic.com. This is Jed Distler, artist in residence for the Classical Network, and welcome to Between the Keys. Stephen Cira is a musician who has worn many hats in his busy musical life. He's a concert pianist who has performed with the Toronto Symphony Orchestra, the Winnipeg Symphony Orchestra, Tulsa Philharmonic, and other orchestras in both Canada and the United States. He was a producer with CBC Radio Music and served as artistic director of the distinguished concert season at the Ford Center for the Performing Arts in Toronto from 1991 to 2000. For 7 years, he was the music critic of the Baltimore Sun, but most importantly, Stephen Cira is my guest this hour on Between the Keys. Welcome. I'm so happy you're here.
Thank you so much, Jed. It's great to be here.
Welcome to New York. I was especially delighted when we were speaking about collaborating on this program and when you were proposing the composer Alexander Scriabin. When you mention the name Scriabin, certain words come to mind, like mystical, necromantic, neurotic, sexy, twisted, words like that come to mind. But tell me, what has been your fascination with Scriabin?
One other word that should come to mind is piano, because the man was obsessed with the piano, and he was a wonderful pianist himself. You know, he was a classmate of Rachmaninoff at the Moscow Conservatoire, though they went in very different directions, obviously, both musically and pianistically, and he had less power, of course, at the keyboard than Rachmaninoff, but a lot of fluency. But what really, he's always been very central to my interests. When I was very young, I don't even remember why, but he was just there. He was always looming. But the event that really triggered my passion for Scriabin was a lecture that was given at Pomona College, which I attended. At the beginning, I think, of my sophomore year there, it was given by a gentleman named Fabian Bowers, who you may even have known.
He was the biographer of Scriabin, wasn't he? He was also a music critic.
Exactly. And he was also an authority on kabuki. And we had a French professor at Pomona who was really interested in kabuki, named the late Leonard Pronko. And he invited Bowers to speak about Scriabin on this occasion. And that really intensified my interest. He talked about his new biography. He wrote a 2-volume biography, which was published in Japan, and I immediately read it and devoured it, and it just, everything escalated from there.
Have you played Scriabin's piano music?
I have, in fact. I've played the 4th Sonata, and I did as an encore on my graduate recital at USC. I did one of the very late poems, which hadn't even been widely published at that point, and Fabian gave me the score of it. And I also have heard performances of it that were, I would practically say, life-changing. I think particularly of a concert in 73, which is near the centenary year. In Los Angeles, I heard the piano concerto played by Ashkenazi with Lauren Mazel conducting. It was around the time that they recorded it.
Right. Vladimir Ashkenazi's recording of this, I think in many ways it's still the reference. What I think is interesting about Scriabin's music is that although he did not live very long, I think he was only 43 when he died.
That's right.
He lived from 1873 to 1915.
72. Yeah.
72.
Although it probably partly depends on if you're going in the old Russian calendar or the Western calendar.
I stand corrected. Yeah. So we don't want to deliver fake news here on Between the Keys. considering his short life, it has always seemed to me that his stylistic metamorphosis was quite an evolution. And it seems that there's quite a difference between the earlier works where you hear something of the influence of Chopin, and then later on it gets into very dark, deep corners that border on atonality sometimes. Since we We're talking about comparing performances. I thought maybe we could start with early Scriabin. Maybe we can talk a little bit about that.
Right. The roots of Scriabin were, as you say, Chopin was an important influence. I think Wagner, to some extent, was an influence. Actually, the two of them shared a certain quality of monomania, shall we call it. In Scriabin's case, may have been partly due to the fact that he was born on Christmas and died around Easter. So that may have affected his mindset for the rest of his life, mm-hmm. perhaps. But the early works are very beautifully written for the instrument, and as I had mentioned, he was a great pianist himself, though without a lot of power. We're going to start with one of the early, very lyrical etudes, played by a legendary Russian interpreter named Vladimir Sofronitsky, who in fact married the daughter of Scriabin, Marina, and people still speak of Sofronitsky with great veneration. He was virtually unknown in the West. I don't think he ever gave a concert west of Paris in his life. He was very much orientated toward the Soviet bloc. Apparently Joseph Stalin loved his playing, and he asked him to play at the Potsdam Conference just after the war. But in any case, this is a very lyrical etude.
This is the etude, Opus 8, number 11, Vladimir Sofronitsky. And this is a live performance, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
Yep. Okay, let's listen. Thank you. That was a very beautiful and lyrical performance, yet very intense, of Alexander Scriabin's Etude, Opus 8, number 11. The pianist was Vladimir Sofronitsky. That was recorded live at the Small Hall in the Moscow Conservatory, May 13th, 1960. That was not long before his death.
That is correct. He did not live very long, like his father-in-law, who died at the age of 43.
This next etude that we are going to hear by Alexander Scriabin is one of his most popular pieces. And in fact, I think one reason for the popularity of this piece is because Vladimir Horowitz made it into a kind of a signature piece. This is the D sharp minor etude, also from Opus 8, number 12. I think Horowitz's influence as far as Scriabin playing, at least in the United States, is really pretty profound.
When he was very young, apparently he was taken to Scriabin to play, and he actually played for Scriabin as a boy in Russia, and that too left an indelible imprint on him, and apparently Scriabin patted him on the head and said, this boy has a wonderful future ahead of him, and he sure was right about that.
I don't think Horowitz was playing Scriabin really early in his career. He was playing a lot of Tchaikovsky, Rachmaninoff. I think he only started to play Scriabin in public in the United States, maybe in the late 40s. I don't know if I'm right or not.
You may well be. Also, his performances, when you listen to them, do have a certain, shall we say, neurotic quality, which is missing when you listen to other interpreters. But there's a kind of electricity and magic. I did hear him play some live Scriabin. It was very special.
This performance of the Etude, Opus 8, number 12, comes from Royal Festival Hall in 1982, and he had not played in London for many, many years. This was kind of a difficult period for him health-wise, and still, this is quite an intense performance. So why don't we listen? Vladimir Horowitz. Opus 8, number 12, in D-sharp minor by Scriabin. That was a live recording from Royal Festival Hall, Vladimir Horowitz at the piano. I'm very curious to compare this to Horowitz's 1962 studio recording. I'm just curious, so why don't we listen to that? right. That was Vladimir Horowitz playing his signature piece, one of his signature pieces, Scriabin's D sharp minor etude. That was his 1962 Columbia Masterworks recording, a studio recording. It's much straighter, I think, compared to the later live one.
Anytime I think that Horowitz played live, you're going to have a little more of the eccentricities and indulgences which are almost to be expected if it's a live rendition in front of an audience. I actually heard Horowitz play this etude also in, if you please, the East Room of the White House for President Carter.
Oh, you were at that concert?
I was at that concert.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, it was quite memorable. And I remember after, there was a nice reception. I mean, all kinds of very interesting people were in the audience, such as Rudolf Serkin and Rostropovich. I mean, it was a great event. And Jimmy Carter, President Carter, was very touched by the event. I remember we were sipping some wine after, and he turned to me and he asked what I did. And I told him that I was the critic in Baltimore. And he said, well, I really want to know what you thought of that performance. He said, for me, I can't imagine better piano playing. I don't know what you thought. He was very touched by it. And it was great to see a president who was so affected by a piece of classical music.
Could you imagine that now?
No. He also said to me, he said that he was obsessed with classical music. This is President Carter. And he said, my secretary over there, it plays in my office regularly every day. And if you want to know what music I listen to, she'll be happy to give you the playlist. He actually said that. I never got the playlist. I didn't follow up on his suggestion, but he wanted to make that point to me.
Let's go to Scriabin's middle period. And tell me something about the changes. What is happening in the music? What's evolving here?
There actually was a year of change, I would say, you could identify, like around 1903, when he was at the beginning of his 30s, his style began to change. The whole concept of flight, of taking off, became very important for Scriabin. His music reflected that impulse much more than it had before. It became less earthbound, so to speak. And you hear that impulse also in the fluttering figurations that he favored. The whole method of piano writing changed in a way that no other composer quite approached or of course, emulated in the future. And I think the piece that captures that for the first time most effectively is probably the fourth sonata. That represents a real turning point for the composer. So I thought it would be good for us to hear that short sonata. And the word sonata had a different implication, of course, for Scriabin than it had for the classical composers. Everything became more concise, more compact, even than he had done in his earlier sonatas, such as number 3, which is in 4 movements, or number 1, which is a more extended piece.
The fourth sonata is in 2 movements, and mm-hmm. the first movement is slow and almost nocturne-like. And when I said the word sexy, I think it kind of applies to this.
Languid is it?
Languid, yeah. That's
and the two movements, of course, are connected. They're not separated. And that's where the flight takes, because the transition between the first and the second movements happens when the music kind of suddenly takes wing, takes off.
You've picked a performance that I think is quite wonderful by Mikhail Pletnev. And what makes this performance special for you?
It's just that the level of piano playing is absolutely fastidious. And as well, I think he understands the idiom quite thoroughly, quite profoundly. It's just a very satisfying performance by a wonderful musician.
Let's listen.
Thank you.
We just heard the Piano Sonata No. 4 by Alexander Scriabin, a two-movement work. Well, the two movements are connected. This is a studio recording by Mikhail Pletnev on Virgin Classics, or EMI, or Warner Classics. Wherever you can find it, I suggest that you find it. In a way, this sonata is kind of a beta version, for lack of a better word, for the sonata that is up ahead, which is the fifth sonata, which is one of his most familiar works, probably because it has one of the most extraordinary beginnings. This is a beginning unlike any other sonata. You hear how the piano goes from bottom to top. It's like fireworks, and it's sudden and intense and surprising and shocking. I would give anything to hear that for the first time.
It is almost like a rocket taking off, too. I mean, you talk about the concept of flight and ignition. This piece escalates from the very beginning. The fourth sonata takes about 2 minutes before it takes wing. Some of the motifs when the next section begins are somewhat reminiscent of the fourth. So the two works are somewhat connected, but this piece looks forward even more.
And before we listen to this sonata, let me remind you that you are listening to Between the Keys here on the Classical Network, and my name is Jed Disler, artist in residence for the Classical Network, and my guest is Stephen Sierra, who has brought in a wonderful selection of Scriabin recordings. So tell me about the pianist you've picked for this performance, Sviatoslav Richter.
Well, Richter, of course, is one of the giants of 20th century piano playing. He is certainly, by any reckoning, one of the major interpreters of Scriabin. I remember in a pre-concert lecture before that 73 performance I mentioned earlier of the piano concerto, somebody in the audience asked Ashkenazi who he most admired among Scriabin pianists in the world. And he said the names that immediately come to mind for him were Horowitz, Richter, and Sofronitsky, who was, of course, less famous. Those are the three that he mentioned. And, of course, Richter belongs in this company, and at his best in Scriabin, like at his best in anything, he was mesmerizing and a performer of a unique kind of electricity, magnetism, but also intellectual control. He kind of had it all. He brought it all together. And, of course, total technical command of the piano. It was, as someone once said, it's hard to imagine the piano being played any better than Richter at his best.
Let's listen to this live performance from Warsaw in 1972. Sviatoslav Richter, the Scriabin Sonata No. 5. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, I am picking myself up from the floor, although my ears are still pinned to the wall after that performance of the Scriabin Fifth Piano Sonata, Opus 53. That was pianist Sviatoslav Richter, and my guest Stephen Sierra has brought in a recording of Richter playing in Warsaw in 1972. That's a live performance. There are several other live performances of Richter in that sonata, but this one, I don't know, to me it seems like it has a little more of an edge and a sense of daring to it, yet technically it's really all there.
And the fact that it was done live compounds the miracle of what he achieved.
Yes, it's true. Well, Richter, I think, did not really like studio recordings. He famously likened the microphone or likened the studio situation to a torture chamber.
Right.
But at the same time, he made many wonderful studio recordings.
That is for sure. I guess the conditions had to be right and he was comfortable and there you go.
By contrast, Vladimir Ashkenazy is a pianist who has thrived in the recording studio, and he has one of the largest discographies of any pianist. It's really quite staggering. In fact, last year for his 80th birthday, we devoted two programs to Ashkenazy's recordings, and I asked my Facebook friends to suggest selections, and I was really surprised because there were so many recordings I hadn't thought about or that I had taken for granted. Scriabin, in a way, is a Ashkenazy specialty.
He's very devoted to that composer. I once heard him say that when he was young and living in Russia, he used to visit the Scriabin Museum very often. He was so obsessed, and he had a friend who did the same. And eventually, the obsession subsided somehow, but the love and the affection have remained to this day. And as a conductor, he's also conducted all of his orchestral works. He's very, very devoted. I think Scriabin is one of the really great composers.
Getting into the late period of Scriabin, or the relative late period, maybe you can say something about the changes in style.
The thing about Scriabin, his whole career was relatively brief. As we said, he died at the age of 43. Effectively, his career was about 20 years long. And when you consider the distance that he traveled musically in that space, it's quite staggering. He never stopped changing and developing throughout. His music later on becomes more concentrated, more daring, more individual, more modern, so to speak, more maniacal, more monomaniacal, and one could argue even more profound in certain ways. He was conveying messages about his feelings about the world. He wanted to possess the world. He once said, "I want to possess the world the way a man possesses a woman." He actually said that. And he was very influenced also by Madame Blavatsky and her theosophical musings. By the time he had died at the age of 43, he had traveled an incredible distance. He had really reached the limits of a language, a musical language that he himself had created. I think we ought to sample some of the late pieces, which are very brief, but very, very interesting and convey very different moods. And so we're going to hear The Enigma from Opus 52, a piece called Desire from Opus 57, and Étrangeté, Strangeness, a very interesting piece from Opus 63, and then ending with Vers la Flamme, Toward the Flame.
Should we hear these all back to back, do you think?
I think certainly the first three we should hear back to back, but maybe take a break before Vers la Flamme.
Okay, and the pianist is Vladimir Ashkenazy. Thank you. We just heard three late pieces, or relatively late pieces, by Alexander Scriabin and Stephen Sira. Can you tell the titles of what we just heard again?
We just heard the Enigma from Opus 52. We heard Désir, or Desire, from Opus 57, and Étrangeté, or Strangeness, from Opus 63.
And the pianist was Vladimir Ashkenazy, and that's a relatively recent recording. This next piece, I first heard it when Vladimir Horowitz recorded it in 1972, Vers la Flamme.
Two of the composer's obsessions, one of were the concept of flight, which I mentioned earlier, and the concept of fire became more and more important. His last great orchestral work, which is, I would say, a flawed masterpiece, is Prometheus, which is a prominent piano part. And Prometheus, of course, was the bringer of fire to the human race. So he was fascinated by that concept of just depicting pyrotechnics, so to speak, in terms of piano writing. There's no better example of that than this five-minute work, Toward the Flame, which is based on a descending interval of a semitone. Throughout the piece, woven throughout the piece, and goes through all kinds of transformations, but it's there from the beginning to the end. And it's a really interesting construction. It's a tour de force of piano virtuosity, and I think it is played with great understanding here by Ashkenazy.
Let's listen. Vladimir Ashkenazi at the piano playing music of Alexander Scriabin, Vers la Flamme. Wonderful, wonderful performance. And thank you for bringing that performance to my attention, Stephen Cira, because I did not know that. I hadn't heard that before, and I'm very glad to know it. I think we've really gotten an insight into Scriabin's music and his creative evolution in what was such a short life. And I really thank you so much, Stephen Cira, for your insights into this wonderful composer and for sharing these performances with us. Thank you so much for being here.
Well, thank you, Jed. It's very good to be with you as well.
And I should tell you that Between the Keys is an exclusive production of the Classical Network and WWFM.org. If you've missed previous episodes or you'd like to hear some of them again, you can stream them as webcasts whenever you want to listen by visiting our website, WWFM.org. I keep playlists for all Between the Keys episodes on my personal website, which is jeddistler.com. And I also have a Between the Keys Facebook page where you can find out about upcoming episodes. I also send out a weekly newsletter, and if you'd like to receive it, just send me an email. This is Jed Distler, artist in residence for the Classical Network, and I hope you will join me next week at this time for Between the Keys. In the meantime, have a good week and be well. See you soon.